Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
From the thunderous liftoff of the Saturn V rocket to the lunar landing to the moment on July 20th, 1969, when Neil Armstrong took that first step on the moon, he carried humanity's hopes and ambitions with him. As we approach the 50th anniversary of that landing, a new film based on the only authorized biography of Armstrong is shining a new light on who he was as a person. Calm, measured, brilliant, and complicated. This hour on Point, Neil Armstrong, hero and human. And you can join us on air or online. What do you remember about the moon landing and those first steps that a human being ever took on the moon? Did that moment, did the fact that it was Neil Armstrong who did that, did it inspire you? And what questions do you have about the famous astronaut? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, we're going to start today with a brief look at this new movie. It's called First Man, directed by Damien Chazelle. And here's a clip of it. It's where a moment in the film where Neil Armstrong, played by Ryan Gosling, talks about the value of space exploration.
I don't know what space exploration will uncover, but I don't think it'll be exploration just for the sake of exploration. I think it'll be more the fact that it allows us to see things that maybe we should have seen a long time ago, but just haven't been able to until now.
A scene from the movie First Man. Well, joining us now from New York is Alyssa Wilkinson, film critic for Vox. Alyssa, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I think this movie, because it's depicting such a momentous period in American and human history, people are reading all sorts of things into it. What's your take on it? Is it a good movie?
Yeah, I mean, I really, really like this movie. I think one of the challenges for filmmakers who are making movies about really famous events that people watched on TV is to find a new angle into the story, something that can resonate and surprise the viewer as we're watching these very familiar events unfold. And First Man manages to do it by going through basically Neil Armstrong's experience being part of the space mission and how that links in with his personal life. So bringing those two pieces together means that it's maybe a different take than people were expecting to see, but it's also more personal. And, you know, maybe you didn't expect to cry during a movie about the moon landing, but I think a lot of people will.
Yeah. So does Ryan Gosling do a good job in his depiction of Neil Armstrong?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're used to seeing lots of great performances out of Ryan Gosling, but this one is kind of stunning, I think. He's very, very understated. Armstrong was a reserved man who really thought before he spoke and never really spoke out of turn and was also very determined and also was dealing with a lot in his personal life. And this is a very understated performance from Gosling that I think actually manages to convey the personality of this person in a really, just wonderful way to watch, and also a performance that maybe we're not used to from Gosling.
Yeah, well, let's listen to another clip from the movie then. This is a scene in which Neil Armstrong's wife, Janet, played by Claire Foy, tells Armstrong, again, Ryan Gosling has the lead role there, that he needs to tell their children about the dangers he's going to face as the first human being on the moon.
Pat doesn't have a husband. Those kids, they don't have a father anymore. What are the chances that's going to be Ricky and Mark? And I can't tell them that their dad spent the last few minutes packing his briefcase. You're going to sit him down, both of them, and you're going to prepare them for the fact that you might not ever come home.
That's Claire Foy playing Janet Armstrong, wife of Neil Armstrong, in the new movie First Man. Alyssa Wilkinson, it's this focus on Armstrong and his family as the heart of the film that I think has actually, it's gotten some people rubbed the wrong way, a completely different way. I mean, I'm looking at a review here from John Podhoretz in the Weekly Standard, and he says the movie ought to be called The Neurotic Stuff, because First Man drains the triumph and exhilaration and excitement and the sort of transcendent human meaning of Neil Armstrong's mission, and instead, in his words, says, chooses a jittery, anxious, tragedy-soaked account deliberately designed to deny its audience any sense of transcendence.
I mean, I think you have to be going in wanting to watch it a certain way to get that. I mean, it's hard to, you know, sort of stand and look through Neil's eyes from the moon out to the Earth, and then he turns and looks at the flag on the moon, he comes back and looks at the Earth and not feel this sense of wonder and transcendence. But I also think that, you know, what First Man does really well is actually show us that being a hero means sacrificing and means, you know, has great personal cost for people, that these are real men who really sacrificed and real women who really sacrificed. They're not figures, they're not icons that we can just project our own fantasies onto, but they're that kind of sacrifice for your country and for the advancement of humankind really, you know, requires you to give up a little bit of yourself.
Hmm. Well, one more thing before we go, Alyssa, because I just want to touch upon with you the fact that a while ago there was this sort of controversy about the fact that Damien Chazelle, the director, opted not to put a scene of the astronauts planting the U.S. flag on the moon, and that people were saying, well, that sort of drains the fact that this was an American mission, even though, you know, all of humanity's hopes were, you know, in terms of that, I keep coming back to that word, transcendent, but humanity's hopes sort of transcending planet Earth and going to the moon, but that it was an American mission. I mean, do you see any credence in that criticism of the film?
Not really. We still get sort of the one small step for man, one giant step for mankind moment. But what we do see is the flag having been on the moon, and because we're watching the moon landing through Neil Armstrong's eyes, we get the sense that he's so overwhelmed, he's barely even registering what's happening while they're on the moon, and he turns and he looks at the flag, and it's like it's a stunning moment. But, you know, throughout the film, there are flags everywhere. It's actually almost comical, given what this debate has been about, that how many flags there are. And it's also positioned very much as the U.S. trying to, you know, have the space race against its rival, the Soviet Union, and how much it meant to the world, really, to have Americans be the first ones to land on the moon. There's actually a woman from, I think, France, who's quoted in the film, who says something like, "I knew the Americans would do it. I knew it." And so that's very much part of the film, but it's also not kind of blindly patriotic in the sense that it also wants us to remember that this was important for people who weren't Americans as well.
Yeah. Well, Alyssa Wilkinson, film critic for Vox. We've got a link to her piece about First Man. That link is at our website, onpointradio.org. Thank you so much for being with us today, Alyssa.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, let's turn now to a man who knew Neil Armstrong well because he wrote the official authorized biography of Neil Armstrong. James Hansen joins us now from Auburn, Alabama. He's a former NASA historian and author of the biography First Man, The Life of Neil A. Armstrong. It's the book upon which the movie is based. James Hansen is also a professor emeritus of history at Auburn University. Professor Hansen, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
It's a delight to have you, truly. And I should note that you also get a producer credit on the movie as well. So how do you think the film did? Is it an accurate depiction of the man that you knew and wrote about?
It's a brilliant and stunning film. It's a terrific interpretation of Neil's character. I had a nice conversation several with Ryan Gosling actually early on, because I was on the set most of the shoot. And Ryan made it clear to me, and I was quite taken with his point of view that, you know, an actor doesn't really try to imitate a character or just sort of robotically, you know, try to fake their voice and to fake their body language. What the actor is trying to do is portray some essential truths about the character. And Ryan did a lot of, I mean, certainly Damien Chazelle, the director, did unbelievably deep research on the whole story. But Ryan not only I mean, it was clear from his discussions with me that he had read my book carefully, and he'd read a lot of other things. I made sure that he got to talk to Neil's sister, June, who really knew Neil very, very well, and he talked with Neil's boys and Neil, friends of Neil's as children. And so, I mean, Ryan really went deep into the research and into the character, and he felt, I think, as I did, he felt a real responsibility to try to, you know, not, again, not to mimic Neil, but to try to get to a very authentic portrayal of him.
You know, I want to talk with you a little later in the hour about a moment in Neil Armstrong's life that the movie focuses a great deal on. That's the death of his toddler daughter. Because I think there's that may be something that a lot of people didn't know had happened to Neil Armstrong and his family. But before we have to take a quick break here, James Hansen, can you just tell me, like, what was Neil Armstrong like? One of the most unique things about him is that after he became the first human to set foot on the moon, he largely shunned publicity and media after that. So he sort of, for a lot of people, remained something of an enigma in the years and decades following the moon landing.
Yeah, he tried to lead as normal a life as he could. He went, after he left NASA, he became a professor of engineering at the University of Cincinnati, hoping that could get him to a normal life. But, you know, this was a man who for many months, even years after Apollo 11, was getting 10,000 fan mail letters a day. And people wanted, you know, wanted all sorts of things from him. They wanted, you know, they wanted signatures. They wanted photographs. They wanted him to come and, you know, open up their car wash. I mean, he just, there was no end to what people wanted from him. And Neil did his best, really, to give them what they wanted. But there had to be limits. And so he was already a pretty tightly emotional character. I mean, his emotions were kept in check. And he did not like the limelight ever. And certainly the moon landing exacerbated that sort of reserved nature.
Wow. Well, we're talking with James R. Hansen. He's former NASA historian and author of the biography First Man, The Life of Neil A. Armstrong. It's the book upon which the new movie is based. And we want to hear from you. What are your questions for the man who's written the biography of Neil Armstrong? What impact or effect did the moon landing have on you in your life? And who do you look at as the Neil Armstrong of today, that quiet, reserved, but powerfully capable character? Who's the American hero that you think might remind you of Neil Armstrong? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about Neil Armstrong, the first human being on the moon. He made that famous moonwalk on July 20th, 1969. And now there's a new movie out that largely focuses on Neil Armstrong. And it's based on the book First Man, The Life of Neil Armstrong, which has been written by James Hansen. He's a former NASA historian and professor emeritus of history at Auburn University. And Professor Hansen, I just want to hear a little bit from Neil Armstrong himself here, because back in 2005, he gave an interview to 60 Minutes. He spoke with reporter Ed Bradley. And Bradley had asked Armstrong in one point of this interview about the confidence that Armstrong portrayed when he gave a big thumbs up to a sign to the media shortly before the Saturn V and the Apollo 11 mission took off.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a sham, I admit. you know, the reality is a lot of times you get up there and get in the cockpit and something goes wrong somewhere and you go back down. So actually, when you actually lift off, it's really a big surprise.
It's Neil Armstrong in 2005. James Hansen, you write in your book, and the movie explores, again, who Neil Armstrong was as a man, his character, his demeanor. And there's a moment in the book where you write about why Armstrong was picked to be the first man to step on the moon and not Buzz Aldrin. And if I got the, if I have the, if I have this right, Chris Kraft, who was the chief of flight operations in Houston, said that Neil was Neil, calm, quiet, and absolute confidence. We all knew he was the Lindbergh type. He had no ego. Meaning what?
Well, they knew that the person who not just commanded the Apollo 11 mission, but in, more importantly, in the sense of who was going to become this global icon, the one who stepped out and represented humanity as the first step onto another heavenly body, that this was going to be a big deal. They imagined that correctly. And there was a private meeting between Chris Kraft and Deke Slayton, the head of the Astronaut Corps, and George Lowe, who was one of the big officials in the manned space program, and Bob Gilruth, who was the director down in Houston. And it was a very private conversation. In fact, you don't find this in any records, only in oral history coming from Kraft. And that was that they were having a discussion. They knew that this was going to be a big deal. And, you know, to the public, what they had said was that the person going out first, the astronaut going out first, would be based on really the interior layout of the LM, the way the hatch opened, the way the two astronauts were positioned inside the lunar module. And that always was what NASA told the public and even told the astronauts as to the reason why they had Neil go out first, because the way the hatch opened, it would be difficult for Buzz to be the first one out. But in truth, this, you know, this meeting was really what the decision was based on, and that was they knew that Neil was the type of personality that they felt would actually could serve as this icon. I mean, there was a lot of public relations, in a sense, to what NASA was doing with the Apollo program, and they wanted the right kind of representative for this. And so it was not just a statement about Armstrong, but it was also kind of a comment on Buzz. I mean, they knew Buzz Aldrin quite well, and they knew he was a very, very proficient astronaut. But they also knew that personality-wise, you know, Buzz was quite a bit different than Neil. He was very extroverted. He was, you know, there was an element of narcissism in Buzz, honestly. There were some commanders, in fact, when I interviewed Frank Borman, who was the commander of Apollo 8, Borman made it very clear to me that he had told Deke Slayton that he would not accept Buzz on his crew. And it wasn't because he wasn't, again, a proficient astronaut. But there were just elements of Buzz's personality which were a little difficult. And Neil could handle them. I mean, and Buzz and he worked together quite well. But they just felt that if, you know, between these two men, there was no question in their mind that Armstrong would be the perfect next Lindbergh, and Buzz would be much more problematic than that.
Wow, interesting. Well, let's step back in time considerably, if we could. I mean, tell us about Neil Armstrong's younger years. I see here that did he first start flying at the age of 6?
He took his first airplane ride.
Okay.
When he was 6.
Okay.
He got his pilot's license on his 16th birthday before he even tried to drive an automobile. He had little interest in automobiles, which was kind of surprising for a boy back in that era. But he had become very passionate about airplanes as a small boy. He saved every penny from everything he did to buy model airplanes that he built and flight magazines of various kinds. And so it was really the passion for airplanes and flying. You know, in later, after he becomes first man and becomes this iconic figure, some biographers, you can read this in a lot of the children's books that have been written about him, suggest that Neil was, you know, looked at the stars and was big into telescopes and read science fiction and all that. Really, none of that's true.
Oh, I mean,
Neil didn't get interested in that until much later. You know, he was really all about airplanes. And what happened was his career, you know, as a pilot, going to Purdue University to become an aircraft designer, becoming a naval aviator that flew in Korea, then becoming a test pilot. What led him to space was really not any, you know, germinal passion on his part as a boy, but really just sort of the the wave of technology in flight as it was progressing from jets to rockets and
right.
out of the atmosphere, and he just went with it.
Well, in your book, you write about how he loved flying so much. I think he told you that when he was a young boy, he would dream about it at night, that he had this recurring dream of holding his breath and hovering over the ground, that he was neither flying or didn't fall, but he was just hovering in his dream.
He did have that story, and what was, I think, really interesting about it was he was very reluctant to tell it to me because he didn't, you know, he was not the sort of person who really, you know, I mean, there was a spiritual side to him, but he wasn't the sort of person who would emphasize, you know, the element of dreams, for example, in who he was or what he became. And so he had this recurring dream, and so he admitted to it, but he was almost embarrassed to do it because I think he ended the story to me by saying, well, I don't think you want to make too much of that, you know. So he was a very practically minded guy,
yeah.
and even as a boy was a type of proto engineer in the way he looked at things.
But also, as you were saying, like profoundly goal oriented and very ambitious, because you write about how you were saying this a minute ago, but it wasn't necessarily some sort of passion for space and space exploration necessarily that drove him, but that all the great aviation accomplishments had already been done, and he kind of resented that, and it was space that was the next step.
Yeah, that was, you know, he had growing up in the 30s, and there were still lots of firsts that were happening in terms of piloting and aviation. And of course, reading all those flight magazines as a boy and building all those models, he was aware of the great pioneering flights of that era, of the pre-World War II era. And he kind of thought as a boy, well, everybody's got those done, and now what's next? Of course, he didn't realize that there were all sorts of things yet to come.
Yeah. Well, so James Hansen, I want to talk with you in some detail about an area of Neil Armstrong's life that the movie focuses on quite a bit, and that's the death of his 2-year-old daughter, Karen. So first of all, let's just play a scene here from the movie First Man. You'll hear Ryan Gosling, who plays Neil Armstrong. In this scene, he's asked about Karen's death.
Neil, I was sorry to hear about your daughter.
I'm sorry, is there a question?
What I mean is, do you think it will have an effect?
I think it would be unreasonable to assume that it wouldn't have some effect.
It's a scene from the movie First Man. James Hansen, first of all, tell us a little bit about Armstrong's daughter and what happened to her.
Well, may I first say that in terms of that scene, what really strikes me, two things strike me the most, and that is one, that Josh Singer, the screenwriter, used verbatim a quote that, I mean, what Neil says in that scene about it being unreasonable to assume that it would have no effect, that comes directly from my interview with him back in the early 2000s. Because I asked him that specific question about did he think it had an effect on his flying and on his career choices afterwards. And that exactly is what he answered. So, of course, I love that scene because it's exactly what Neil said. The other thing about the scene, which I think is relevant to your question, is that no one – I mean, that question was not truly asked at his interview because no one there knew about it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the death of the child was so private that the panel that chose him had no idea that he even had a daughter or that a daughter had died.
He applied to the astronaut program after her death. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, he does, a few months after. She was her name was Karen Ann Armstrong. Neil's nickname for her was Muffy. And she had a glioma of the pons, a very malignant tumor that they tried to treat with cobalt radiation, which was had all kinds of horrible side effects and was not successful. The little girl had, you know, she was 2.5 when she died. She had you know, been able to walk, you know, I think at a little over a year. But because of the radiation, she had lost the ability to walk. I heard a lot of stories. I mean, I asked Neil, of course, to talk to me about Karen as much as possible. And he was still, you know, many, many years later, quite limited in what he would, you know, say to me about her. But what I did learn mostly came from, I mean, really from my book, and this was an essential insight that the movie makers picked up on, because I have a chapter in the book called The Worst Loss, and it's really all about the death of the child. And really, I got my greatest insights from the women in Neil's life, uh-huh. from his sister June and from Janet herself. I had extensive interviews with both of them, and they're the ones that commented most on what really happened with the daughter and Neil's and the impact on Neil. They told me stories, anecdotes, which I included in the book that aren't in the movie, that really illuminate how deeply Neil had loved his daughter and what a special relationship the two of them had impact she had, the death had on him.
So forgive me for interrupting here, but this is so interesting because there are a lot of movie reviewers who say, or at least some very high prominent ones, who say mm-hmm. that they thought that the movie focused too much on the mm-hmm. effect of Karen's death on Armstrong. I mean, I'm reading a review here from Anthony Lane in The New Yorker, and he says the whole narrative is shaped around the death of his daughter, that he has visions of her when he least expects them, even upon reaching his destination, i.e. the moon. Is that really a teardrop that we see inside his helmet sliding down his cheek? And they say that perhaps that's not fair to Armstrong. Was he that consumed by the death of his daughter for so long?
Well, my own reaction to that is, you know, and I understand reviewers. I was a journalist at one point in my college career, and so I appreciate what reviewers do and the challenges and what they try to do in their reviews. But I sort of think, you know, how dare they suggest something that, you know. Have they experienced the loss of a child? Do they know what the effects of that are? I mean, I've had lots of people write me that have seen some of these reviews that have said exactly those sorts of things to me. Just because that doesn't fit our image of the, you know, the astronaut as icon, you know, these steely-eyed missile men who don't fear death. And, you know, the suggestion that an astronaut would not have a tear in his eye at any point. I mean, a number of the astronauts remembered family in quite direct ways on the lunar surface. And to suggest that the death of Neil's child, just because Neil didn't talk about it, to me, that's a dead giveaway that this is something very fundamentally, you know, important and profound in his psyche. And they didn't talk, you know, they didn't talk to Janet. They didn't talk to Neil's sister and hear the stories that I heard about the impact. And I studied Neil's flying in the months before he becomes an astronaut. You can look at his flights. He has a series of troubled flights that he'd never had in his career. And they seem clearly they seem to come from the aftermath of the death of the daughter. Well, so to me, it's like, I mean, I just don't, it's hard for me to accept that critique when the reviewers don't really
understand. Yeah.
They just don't know what they don't know.
I want to play a little bit of tape here from, again, Neil Armstrong himself about this issue, about the death of his daughter, because in 2005, this is from that extended 60 Minutes interview again, Ed Bradley asked Armstrong about Karen's death, and Bradley said, "Did that affect your work at the time?" Basically noting that some people do distract themselves with work after an unspeakable tragedy like this. And here's what Armstrong said.
"It's difficult for me to know. I thought the best thing for me to do in that situation was to continue with my work, keep things as normal as I could, and try as hard as I could not to have it affect my ability to do useful things."
"But that's not an easy thing to do. How do you think you did?"
"At the time, I thought the family was handling it well, and I was doing it best I could."
Neil Armstrong in 2005, and to my ear, what I hear there is a father who still feels the pain of his daughter's death 43 years later. Let's get a quick call in here before we have to take a break. Let's go to Mary, who's calling from Tonawanda, New York. You're on the air, Mary.
"Hi. I have a very important family experience related to the landing. My father, who was born in 1894, was in his latter days. And throughout his lifetime, although he wasn't well-educated, he had been very interested in science, done a lot of reading. And at the time of the landing, he was in the hospital in a coma. And the family had not been able to connect anything to know that he was at all alert. We thought he was in a very deep coma. I went in and held his hand and said, 'Daddy, we've landed a man on the moon.' And he went, 'Oh!' It was the only response we'd had for weeks with him to know that he was alert and listening.
Oh my
and
goodness.
It made a huge impression on him because he had been in on all the activity preparing for this, and it was such a wonderful thing to know that we were still with him and that he could actually, in his last days, realize that we had accomplished this.
Wow. Mary, thank you for your call. James Hansen, we've got a minute to go here before the break. Just what an incredible story that Neil Armstrong's landing on the moon penetrated the fog of her father's coma and got a response for just at least that one time.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. I mean, people do have very clear recollections of what they were doing at the time. That's the most astounding story that I've heard in terms of the reaction.
Well, I mean, I'm sure you talked with Armstrong for what, more than 50 hours? You have 50 hours worth of interviews for this book. We just got a couple seconds here before the break, so maybe I'll get more of an answer from you after we come back from the break. But I want to know is how much he took on board, what this meant, his action meant for all of humanity.
I think we can tell it in the things that he said. I mean, his statement sounds perhaps, you know, since we've heard it so many times, sounds like it's, I don't know, trite. But I think for him to, in the moment, to come up with that phrase, one small step, one giant leap, he's thinking beyond himself. He's thinking for all mankind, just as the plaque on the lunar lander itself said, we come in peace for all mankind. And Neil could think outside and think beyond his own self-interest. And I think that says a lot for him.
Well, we're talking to James Hansen. He is author of the biography First Man, The Life of Neil A. Armstrong. It's the basis for the new movie, First Man. James Hansen is also a former NASA historian, and we want to hear from you. 1969 is when it happened, so next year is the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing. Do you remember that moment? And what does it mean to hear about the kind of person Neil Armstrong was? Who do you think is the modern-day American hero who matches his demeanor? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking today with James Hansen. He's a former NASA historian and author of the biography First Man, The Life of Neil A. Armstrong. It's the book upon which the new movie starring Ryan Gosling is based. That movie is also called First Man. And just before the break, James Hansen was reminding us of course, those immortal words, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind, that Neil Armstrong said when he first stepped foot on the moon. In 2005, to 60 Minutes, Armstrong explained what was going through his mind at the moment he said those words.
I thought, well, when I step off, it's just going to be a little step. It's going to be a step from there down to there. But then I thought about all those 400,000 people that had given me the opportunity to make that step and thought, it's going to be a big something for all those folks, and indeed a lot of others that even weren't even involved in the project. So it was a kind of a simple correlation of thoughts.
Neil Armstrong in 2005. And how remarkably understated is he, James Hansen, saying, yeah, I kind of thought it was going to be something big for people who weren't even involved in that. It's kind of a simple correlation of thoughts. Yeah, I think his humility is incredible.
Don't you love that phrase, simple correlation? I mean, that comes from an engineer, I think. As I said, and one thing that I get this question a lot, you know, did he come up with that phrase long before they landed? Neil's answer always was that he, you know, there was some chance they weren't going to land. I mean, there were lots of things that had to go right before they actually could land. And why think about what you're going to say when you step out and if you're not even going to do it? So he told me and he told everyone is whenever he was asked that he didn't really come up with the phrase until after they had landed. And they had a few hours before they to get ready and suit up and that he composed it in his head while, you know, after the landing.
Yeah. So, well, was he supposed to say, was he supposed to say one small step for a man?
Well, that's what he thought he did say, in fact. To his dying day, that's what he thought. And there's actually been a lot of acoustical analysis that's been done by different experts to see. And I was actually at a Smithsonian demonstration where NASA officials and Neil back in 2004, I think it was. And there was an Australian acoustics guy who played, and he had evidence, he thought, that in the electronic register of the sound waves that you saw something there that was apparently an attempt to make the A, but it wasn't audible. So I don't know. I mean, there's no way really, I don't think, to resolve this completely. Neil, you know, in Neil's inimitable way, told me, he said, well, just put the A in parentheses.
Oh, I see. Well, James Hansen, hold on here for just a second, because I have to say this moment – For those people who witnessed the launching of the Saturn V rocket, who saw those grainy television images of Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walking on the moon, and also, by the way, we should note Michael Collins as well, orbiting around the moon alone as Armstrong and Aldrin were on the lunar surface, it really left a lasting impact on the millions of people who remember it, because something totally delightful happened to us this morning. We got an email out of the blue from Maria Lane. She's in Watertown, Massachusetts, because she had heard one of our little promos that we were going to talk to you today about Neil Armstrong. So Maria sent us this email out of the blue, along with some pictures that she took in Hawaii when the Apollo 11 crew returned to Earth. And it's just such a wonderful story that we invited Maria to be on the show with us. So she joins us now. Maria, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you so much. It's my great pleasure to be with you.
It is wonderful to have you. And I want everyone to go to onpointradio.org and check out these photographs that Maria sent us, because they're these beautiful black and white pictures of the Airstream vehicle that Armstrong and Aldrin and Collins were in after they came back to Earth. What were you doing in Hawaii, first of all? What happened on that day?
Well, I was visiting my Uncle Frank, who and his family. We were very close, and I was 13, and he was on Hickam Air Force Base as commander of a large C-124 cargo plane, and that was during Vietnam, of course, the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
So we got word that the NASA Mobile Quarantine Facility, a streamlined trailer, would be traveling behind my uncle's house with the astronauts after they touched down in the ocean and were picked up by a ship.
Uh-huh. And so the pictures that you sent us, there's one in particular. We see you and your uncle standing there with the streamlined trailer going by. And there's another photograph where Buzz Aldrin is in the window kind of waving at you.
Yes, yes. And the feeling was, you know, that he was just overjoyed to be home. I mean, yeah, it was a giant step for mankind, and they actually returned from the moon.
Yeah. Well, so all these years later, Maria, why is it that you still feel such like a powerful resonance to that moment?
Well, you know, I'm still astonished at the courage of the astronauts, their families, the ingenuity of the enormous team that made it all happen. And there was some discussion about the movie and the book, and that they went up in this space capsule that looks like, you know, maybe a little bit rickety compared to today's sophisticated spaceships.
It looks like a tin can, to be perfectly honest.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's still so moving and so astonishing.
Well, Maria Lane from Watertown, Massachusetts, thank you so much for getting on the phone with us. And thank you for sending us those remarkable photographs. We're going to share them with everyone who wants to see them at onpointradio.org. Again, it's images that Maria took in Hawaii of the NASA mobile quarantine unit, the streamlined trailer with Buzz Aldrin waving from the window after he'd returned from the moon. Maria, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I'm so thrilled.
Well, let's go now to Margo, who's calling from Portland, Maine. Margo, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. I wanted to call in and thank you for covering this new movie. I'm the mother of three children and a teacher. And when my children were young, I always enjoyed sharing with them people who had heroic tendencies, who went beyond kind of the human to sacrifice and to do something for others. And I came upon a musician, Jonathan Sprout, who sings a wonderful song about Neil Armstrong as the first man on the moon. And it was so powerful because Jonathan's music is educational, but it's also very enjoyable. Sometimes mothers and fathers listen to children's music and they just, you know, they have to grin and bear it, you know, but Jonathan's music is, it's beautiful music and the lyrics are educational, but yeah, you don't feel like you're being force fed, and they inspire you. And he sings about, not only Neil Armstrong, but he sings about Samantha Smith, who is from Maine and went to the Soviet Union to reach out at a similar time that we're in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Samantha reached out to this, to the leader of the Soviet Union and said, why is it that we cannot, you know, we are all human. Why can we not get along and come to know each other? And she traveled there with her dad. And I just think that it's so important in this day and very challenging times politically that can we reach across and say we are all human. You know, we are not one political point of view or we are not one ethnic point of view.
Yeah.
We are one creation.
Yeah.
Well,
Margo, let me just take. Yeah, I very much appreciate your call. James Hansen, that sort of unifying moment that came, I mean, whether there were not everyone felt unified, but there was a sense of transcending usual political barriers in 1969 around the lunar landing. I mean, just tell me a little bit more about when you were able to talk to Neil Armstrong many years later about that. What did he think of that?
Well, I think one point Neil made was it was too bad that it didn't last longer, that feeling didn't last longer. Of course, you know, one thing we try to do in the movie and I do in the book and people remember historically is that this was a very turbulent time, not just in the United States, but around the world. I mean, just the year previously, we had had the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. We had had the very, you know, the very heated Chicago Democratic Convention. We'd had, you know, the Vietnam War was, protests were reaching a peak. And the moon landing sort of became a respite. It was a brief respite from that. And even, I mean, I remember, I've read some accounts of soldiers in Vietnam, you know, looking up at the night sky from, you know, from a jungle environment and realizing that their country had a spacecraft that was heading to the moon and you know, lots of ambivalent feelings, you know, about it. But again, I think for the moment of the landing and the walk onto the lunar surface, you know, everyone did sort of just take a, you know, put a pause on everything else. And there were protesters. I mean, Reverend Ralph Abernathy from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Martin Luther King's successor, there were protesters at the launch of Apollo 11. But they took a respite. I mean, they actually – Abernathy made comments afterwards about how, you know, how marvelous and miraculous the launch was and the whole mission was. So even though they had legitimate grievances and concerns and they continued afterwards, everybody just sort of called, oh, let's take a time out and feel this because it was such an epic moment in the history of our species.
Well, let's take another call here. Tom is calling from Manchester, Connecticut. Tom, you're on the air.
Hello. Yes. African-American gentleman in my early 60s. I was 13 years old at the time when it happened. I remember seeing the grainy, you know, footage and the speech, and it was quite, you know, remarkable when Mr. Armstrong, you know, walked on the moon, and I guess it was on CBS Evening News with, you know, with Walter Cronkite. kite. And I did see the movie. I think it was like 2 hours and 20 minutes a week ago Friday when it first opened. And I was impressed by the acting, the fashions of the, you know, the time, even, you know, wife that, you know, the actress that portrayed his wife, I guess, sometimes with the chain-smoking, too. But she was a very strong woman. He was a decent, you know, father. And I think there's a children's book that just came out about that, who was Neil Armstrong, an illustrated book that just came out within the last year or two. And it was very good. But I just wanted to point out something about black astronaut that was shown in a scene of a movie about the training accident. I guess it was Frederick Dwight, Major Frederick Dwight. I guess he died in a training accident, and he left behind a wife and a young son. So I was hoping, I wish a black actor could have portrayed him and, you know, his selection process. Maybe a documentary can come out about
There's an image of him, though, in the movie, you said.
Yeah. A picture, but still... he shouldn't be forgotten. And I think when you're talking about quiet hero, I would say maybe Scott Kelly recently, one of the twin brothers that went up a year ago in the moon. We're about the same age. It's 62. And I would see Colonel Gwynne Bluford was the first black up in space in 1984. And I'll end with this. Don't forget about the women that were first rejected, too. There was a group of them in 67, and I guess it was an objection by Colonel John Glenn, I guess the late congressman, about, you know, keeping them out in a documentary years ago.
Well, Tom, I'm going to have to take it back from you here, but I really appreciate your call. James Hansen there, you heard Tom give a whole list of folks that he also feels are quiet heroes coming out of the U.S. space program, including the image of an African-American astronaut from the Apollo program. Is that what I heard him say?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, really in the Air Force program, but... Yeah, I mean, these are important stories, and I think one of the things that I'm hoping to do, and I've tried to do in my career, is make these other stories available as well. I mean, Neil's story is Neil's story, and we try to make that as accurate. You know, it's not a complete history of the space program or of Apollo even. It's his personal journey. But there are so many other stories, and I mean, Hidden Figures was a terrific movie and a great book. I actually worked on, in my very first book back in the 1980s, I actually interviewed Katherine Johnson and a number of the women computers that worked at NASA Langley. And so these are stories that I think hopefully we're going to be taking a lot of fresh looks at that whole period and working to demythologize and give much greater context to the history of the era than what we've done so far.
Well, we've just got a couple minutes left to go, James Hansen, and I have some questions about sort of where we are today. What would Neil Armstrong have made of where the space program is now? Or, you know, the idea that we'll go to Mars? Would he rather have us go back to the moon? And also, what do you think he'd make of President Trump's idea for Space Force?
Yeah, good questions. I've always tried not to, you know, unless I know exactly what Neil had to say, I have a hard time trying to play his part for him now that he's gone, unfortunately. But, you know, he did in his last years of his life after the cancellation of the Constellation program. He did testify before Congress along with Gene Cernan and Jim Lovell, a couple of other Apollo astronauts, and they were quite concerned. They thought, you know, that the Constellation and the idea of going back to the moon was important, and they also thought that the shuttle program perhaps should have continued on until the United States had the ability to. You know, I don't think Neil was in favor of having our astronauts go to the space station on top of Russian spacecraft. So he wanted the shuttle to continue.
Yeah.
The most profound thing from Neil is, I really have taken to heart, and that is, you know, Neil made comments that, you know, our Earth is a spaceship. It's a very unique type of spaceship because the crew and the passengers are on the outside of the vessel rather than the inside. But we are a spaceship. We are in space, and we have to take care of our spaceship too. You know, and I think he had interests that, and he wasn't I wouldn't call him an environmental activist in any sense, but he was certainly sensitive to it. And I remember having a long conversation with him during the interviews about the state of our oceans that he was very concerned about. So, you know, I think people have this sort of old, you know, almost medieval concept that we have the Earth and we have space. Well, the Earth is a space object. We are in space all of the time. We're traveling through space. We're not exactly even sure where we are relative to, you know, know, lots of things in space. And so I think that that is a kind of consistent with the what the little clip you played from the movie, that space changes our perspective.
Yeah.
And that can lead to really profound changes in our imagination and the way we look at the world.
Well, James Hansen, former NASA historian and author of the biography First Man, The Life of Neil A. Armstrong. It's the book upon which the new movie First Man is based. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you, Professor Hansen. Thank you so very much.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you.
You know, we've been getting a lot of comments about the NASA program and about Neil Armstrong. One from our website, onpointradio.org, is from Gregors. It says, who does remind one of Neil Armstrong? Gregor says, the current U.S. seems like the antithesis of Armstrong's quiet competence. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits, so you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation, and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.